accord with any one person, even a person as stupid and loyal as Lloyd Henreid? An expression of bewilderment rippled across his face. Had he been making such stupid decisions all along? And just how loyal was Lloyd, anyway? That expression in his eyes. Abruptly, he decided to push it all aside and levitate. That always made him feel better. It made him feel stronger, more serene, and it cleared his head. He looked out at the desert sky. "I am. I am. I am. I am." His run-down boot heels left the surface of the sun deck, hovered, rose another inch, then two. Peace came to him, and suddenly he knew he could find the answers. Everything was clearer. First he must... "They're coming for you, you know." He crashed back down at the sound of that soft, uninflected voice. The jarring shock went up his legs and his spine all the way to his jaw, which clicked. He whirled around like a cat. But his blooming grin withered when he saw Nadine. She was dressed in a white nightgown, yards of gauzy material that billowed around her body. Her hair, as white as the gown, blew about her face. She looked like some pallid, deranged sibyl, and in spite of himself, Flagg was afraid. She took a delicate step closer. Her feet were bare. "They're coming. Stu Redman, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, and Larry Underwood. They're coming, and they'll kill you like a chicken-stealing weasel." "They're in Boulder," he said, "hiding under their beds and mourning their dead nigger woman." "No," she said indifferently. "They're almost in Utah now. They'll be here soon, and they'll stamp you out like a disease."
"Shut up. Go downstairs."
"I'll go down," she said, approaching him, and now it was she who smiled, a smile that filled him with dread. The furious color faded from his cheeks, and his strange hot vitality seemed to go with it. For a moment he seemed old and frail.
"I'll go down, and so will you."
"Get out."
"We'll go down," she sang, smiling.
It was horrible.
"Down, down."
"They're in Boulder."
"They're almost here."
"Get downstairs."
"Everything you made here is falling apart, and why not? The effective half-life of evil is always relatively short. People are whispering about you. They're saying you let Tom Cullen get away. Just a simple retarded boy, but smart enough to outwit Randall Flagg."
Her words came faster and faster, now tumbling through a jeering smile.
"They're saying your weapons expert has gone crazy and you didn't know it was going to happen. They're afraid that what he brings back from the desert next time may be for them instead of for the people in the East. And they're leaving. Did you know that?"
"You lie," he whispered.
His face was parchment white, his eyes bulging.
"They wouldn't dare. And if they were, I'd know."
Her eyes gazed blankly over his shoulder to the east.
"I see them," she whispered. "They're leaving their posts in the dead of night, and your eye doesn't see them. They're leaving their posts and sneaking away. A work crew goes out with 20 people and comes back with 18. The border guards are defecting. They're afraid the balance of power is shifting on its arm. They're leaving you, and the ones that are left won't lift a finger when the men from the east come to finish you once and for all."
It snapped. Whatever there was inside him, it snapped.
"You lie!"
he screamed at her. His hands slammed down on her shoulders, snapping both collarbones like pencils. He lifted her body high over his head into the faded blue desert sky, and as he pivoted on his heels, he threw her up and out as he had thrown the glass. He saw the great smile of relief and triumph on her face, the sudden sanity in her eyes, and understood. She had baited him into doing it, understanding somehow that only he could set her free.
And she was carrying his child.
He leaned over the low parapet, almost overbalancing, trying to call back the irrevocable. Her nightgown fluttered. His hand closed on the gauzy material, and he felt it rip,
leaving him only a scrap of cloth so diaphanous that he could see his fingers through it. The stuff of dreams on waking. Then she was gone, plummeting straight down with her toes pointed toward the earth, her gown billowing up her neck and over her face in drifts. She didn't scream. She went down as silently as a defective skyrocket. When he heard the indescribable thud of her hard landing, Flag threw his head back to the sky and howled.
It made no difference. It made no difference.
It was still all in the palm of his hand. He leaned over the parapet again and watched them come running, like iron filings drawn to a magnet, or maggots to a piece of offal. They looked so small, and he was so high above them. He would levitate, he decided, and regain his state of calm. But it was a long, long time before his boot heels would leave the sun deck, and when they did, they would only hover a quarter of an inch above the concrete. They would go no higher. Tom awoke that night at 8 o'clock, but there was still too much light to move. He waited. Nick had come to him again in his sleep, and they had talked. It was so good to talk to Nick. He lay in the shade of the big rock and watched the sky darken. The stars began to peep out. He thought about Pringle's potato chips and wished he had some. When he got back to the zone, if he did get back to the zone, he would have all of them he wanted. He would gorge on Pringle's chips and bask in the love of his friends. That was what was missing back there in Las Vegas, he decided. Simple love. They were nice enough people and all, but there wasn't much love in them, because they were too busy being afraid. Love didn't grow very well in a place where there was only fear, just as plants didn't grow very well in a place where it was always dark. Only mushrooms and toadstools grew big and fat in the dark. Even he knew that. Laws, yes. "I love Nick and Franny and Dick Ellis and Lucy," Tom whispered. It was his prayer. "I love Larry Underwood and Glenn Bateman, too. I love Stan and Rona. I love Ralph. I love Stu. I love..." It was odd how easily their names came to him. Why, back in the zone, he was lucky if he could remember Stu's name when he came to visit. His thoughts turned to his toys, his garage, his cars, his model trains. He had played with them by the hour. But he wondered if he would want to play with them so much when he got back from this. If he got back. It wouldn't be the same. That was sad, but maybe it was also good. "The Lord is my shepherd," he recited softly. "I shall not want for nothing. He makes me lie down in the green pastures. He greases up my head with oil. He gives me kung fu in the face of my enemies. Amen." It was dark enough now, and he pushed on. By 11:30 that night he had reached God's Finger, and he paused there for a little lunch. The ground was high here, and looking back the way he had come, he could see moving lights. On the turnpike, he thought. "They're looking for me." Tom turned northeast again. Far ahead, barely visible in the dark, the moon, now 2 nights past full, had already begun to sink. He saw a huge rounded granite dome. He was supposed to go there next. "Tom's got sore feet," he whispered to himself, but not without some cheeriness. Things could have been much worse than a case of sore feet. M-O-O-N, that spells sore feet. He walked on, and the night things skittered away from him. And when he laid himself down at dawn, he had come almost 40 miles. The Nevada-Utah border was not far to the east of him. By 8 that morning he was hard asleep, his head pillowed on his jacket. His eyes began to move rapidly back and forth behind his closed lids. Nick had come, and Nick talked with him. A frown creased Tom's sleeping brow. He had told Nick how much he was looking forward to seeing him. But for some reason he could not understand. Nick had turned away. Chapter 68. Oh, how history repeats itself. Trash Can Man was once again being broiled alive in the devil's frying pan, but this time there was no hope of Cibola's cooling fountains to sustain him. "It's what I deserve, no more than what I deserve." His skin had burned, peeled again, and finally it had not tanned but blackened. He was walking proof that a man finally takes on the look of what he is. Trash looked as if someone had doused him in No. 2 kerosene and struck a match to him. The blue of his eyes had faded in the constant desert glare, and looking into them was like looking into weird extra-dimensional holes in space. He was dressed in a strange imitation of the dark man, an open-throated red-checked shirt, faded jeans, and desert boots that were already scratched and mashed and folded and sprung. But he had thrown away his red flawed amulet. He didn't deserve to wear it. He had proved unworthy. And like all imperfect devils, he had been cast out. He paused in the broiling sun and passed a thin and shaking hand across his brow. He had been meant for this place and time. All his life had been preparation. He had passed through the burning corridors of hell to get here. He had endured the father-killing sheriff. He had endured that place at Terre Haute. He had endured Carly Yates. After all his strange and lonely life, he had found friends. Lloyd, Ken, Whitney Horgan. And, ah, God, he had fucked it all up. He deserved to burn out here in the devil's frying pan. Could there be redemption for him? The dark man might know. Trash Can did not. He could barely remember now what had happened, perhaps because his tortured mind did not want to remember. He had been in the desert for over a week before his last disastrous return to Indian Springs. A scorpion had stung him on the middle finger of his left hand, his fuck finger that long-ago Carly Yates in that long-ago Poutonville would have called it with unfailing pool-hall vulgarity. And that hand had swelled up like a rubber glove filled with water. An unearthly fire had filled his head, and yet he had pushed on. He had finally returned to Indian Springs, still feeling like a figment of someone else's imagination. There had been some good-natured talk as the men examined his finds, incendiary fuses, contact landmines, small stuff, really. Trash had begun to feel good for the first time since the scorpion had stung him. And then, with no warning at all, time had sideslipped and he was back in Poutonville. Someone had said, "People who play with fire wet the bed, Trash." And he had looked up, expecting to see Billy Jameson, but it hadn't been Bill. It was Rich Groudamore from Poutonville, grinning and picking his teeth with a match, his fingers black with grease because he'd strolled up to the pool hall from the Texaco on the corner to have a game of 9-ball on his break. And someone else said, "You better put that away, Richie. Trash is back in town." And that sounded like Steve Tobin at first, but it wasn't Steve. It was Carly Yates in his old scuffed and hoodie motorcycle jacket. With growing horror, he had seen they were all there. Unquiet corpses come back to life. Richie Groudamore and Carly and Norm Morissette and Hatch Cunningham, the one who was getting bald even though he was only 18 and all of the others called him Hatch Cunnilingus. And they were leering at him. It came thick and fast then, through a fever haze of years. "Hey, Trash, why didn't you torch the school? Hey, Trashy, you burned your pork off yet? Hey, Trash Can Man, I heard you snort Ronson lighter fluid, that true?" Then Carly Yates. "Hey, Trash, what did old Lady Semple say when you torched her pension check?" He tried to scream at them, but all that had come out was a whisper. "Don't ask me about old Lady Semple's pension check no more." And he ran. The rest of it was a dream, getting the incendiary fuses and slapping them on the trucks in the motor pool. His hands had done their own work, his mind far away in a confused whirl. People had seen him coming and going between the motor pool and his sand track with its big balloon tires, and some of them had even waved, but no one had come over and asked what he was doing. After all, he wore Flag's charm. Trashy did his work and thought about Terre Haute. In Terre Haute they had made him bite on a rubber thing when they gave him the shocks, and the man at the controls sometimes looked like the father-killing sheriff, and sometimes like Carly Yates, and sometimes like Hatch Cunnilingus. And he always swore hysterically to himself that this time he wouldn't piss himself. And he always did. When the trucks were fixed, he had gone into the nearest hangar and had fixed the choppers in there. He had wanted timer fuses to do that job right, and so he had gone into the mess hall kitchen and had found over a dozen of those five-and-dime plastic timers. You set them for 15 minutes or half an hour, and when they got back to zero, they went ding, and you knew it was time to take your pie out of the oven. Only instead of going ding this time, Trash had thought, they are going to go bang. He liked that. That was pretty good. If Carly Yates or Rich Groudamore tried taking one of those copters up, they were going to get a big fat surprise. He had simply hooked the kitchen timers up to the copter ignition systems. When it was done, a moment of sanity had come back. A moment of choice. He had stared around wonderingly at the helicopters parked in the echoing hangar, and then down at his hands. They smelled like a roll of burned caps. But this was not Poutonville. There were no helicopters in Poutonville. The Indiana sun did not shine with the savage brilliance of this sun. He was in Nevada. Carly and his pool hall buddies were dead. Dead of the superflu. Trash had turned around and looked doubtfully at his handiwork. What was he doing sabotaging the dark man's equipment? It was senseless, insane. He would undo it, and quickly. Oh, but the lovely explosions. The lovely fires. Flaming jet fuel streaming everywhere. Helicopters exploding out of the air. So beautiful. And he had suddenly thrown his new life away. He had trotted back to his sand crawler, a furtive grin on his sun-blackened face. He had gotten in and had driven away, but not too far away. He had waited. And finally a fuel truck had come out of the motor pool garage and had trundled across the tarmac like a large olive-drab beetle. And when it blew, exploding greasy fire in every direction, Trash had dropped his field glasses and had bellowed at the sky, shaking his fists in inarticulate joy. But the joy had not lasted long. It had been replaced by deadly terror and sick morning sorrow. He had driven northwest into the desert, pushing the sand crawler along at near suicidal speeds. How long ago? He didn't know. If he had been told that this was the 16th of September, he would only have nodded in a total blank lack of understanding. He thought he would kill himself, that there was nothing else left for him. Every hand was turned against him now, and that was just as it was supposed to be. When you bit the hand that fed you, you expected that extended hand to curl into a fist. That wasn't only the way life went, that was justice. He had 3 large cans of gasoline in the back of the track. He would pour it all over himself and then strike a match. It was what he deserved. But he hadn't done it. He didn't know why. Some force, more powerful than the agony of his remorse and loneliness, had stopped him. It seemed that even burning himself to death like a Buddhist monk was not penance enough. He had slept. And when he awoke, he discovered that a new thought had crept into his brain as he slept. And that thought was redemption. Was it possible? He didn't know. But if he found something, something big, and brought it to the dark man in Las Vegas, might it not be possible? And even if redemption was impossible, perhaps atonement was not. If it was true, there was still a chance he could die content. What? What could it be? What was big enough for redemption, or even for atonement? Not landmines or a fleet of flame tracks, not grenades or automatic weapons. None of those things were big enough. He knew where there were 2 large experimental bombers. They had been built without congressional knowledge, paid for out of blind defense funds. But he could not get them back to Vegas, and even if he could, there was no one there who could fly them. From the looks of them, they crewed at least 10, maybe more. He was like an infrared scope that senses heat in darkness and reveals those heat sources as vague red devil shapes. He was able, in some strange way, to sense the things that had been left behind in this wasteland, where so many military projects had been carried out. He could have gone straight west, straight to Project Blue, where the whole thing had begun. But Cold Plague was not to his taste, and in his confused but not entirely illogical way, he thought it would not be to Flag's taste either. Plague didn't care who it killed. It might have been better for the human race if the original funders of Project Blue had kept that simple fact in mind. So he had gone northwest from Indian Springs, into the sandy desolation of the Nellis Air Force Range, stopping his crawler when he had to cut through high barbed wire fences marked with signs that read, U.S. Government Property, No Trespassing, and Armed Sentries, and Guard Dogs, and There is a high-voltage charge passing through these wires. But the electricity was dead, like the guard dogs and the armed sentries, and Trash Can Man drove on, correcting his course from time to time. He was being drawn to something. He didn't know what it was, but he thought it was big. Big enough. The crawler's Goodyear balloon tires rolled steadily on, carrying trash through dry washes and up slopes so rocky that they looked like half-exposed stegosaurus spines. The air hung still and dry. The temperature hovered at just above 100. The only sound was the drone of the crawler's modified Studebaker engine. He topped a knoll, saw what was below, and threw the transmission into neutral for a moment to get a better look. There was a huddled complex of buildings down there, shimmering through the rising heat like quicksilver. Quonset huts and low cinder block. Vehicles stalled here and there on dusty streets. The whole area was surrounded by three courses of barbed wire, and he could see the porcelain conductors along the wire. These were not the small conductors the size of a knuckle that passed along a weak stay-away charge. These were giant ones, the size of a closed fist. From the east, a paved two-lane road led to a guardhouse that looked like a reinforced pillbox. No cute little signs here saying, check your camera with MP on duty, or if you liked us, tell your congressman. The only sign in evidence was red on yellow, the colors of danger, curt and to the point. Present identification immediately.
Thank you, Trash Can whispered.
He had no idea who he was thanking.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
His special sense had led him to this place, but he had known it was here all along, somewhere. He put the sand track in its forward gear and lurched down the slope. 10 minutes later, he was nosing up the access road to the guardhouse. There were black and white striped crash barriers across the road, and Trash got out to examine them. Places like this had big generators to make sure there was plenty of emergency power. He doubted if any generator would have gone on supplying power for 3 months, but he would still have to be very careful and make sure everything was blown before going in. What he wanted was now very near at hand. He wouldn't allow himself to become overeager and get cooked like a roast in a microwave oven. Behind 6 inches of bulletproof glass, a mummy in an army uniform stared out and beyond him. Trash ducked under the crash barrier on the ingress side of the guardhouse and approached the door of the little concrete building. He tried it, and it opened. That was good. When a place like this had to switch over to emergency power, everything was supposed to lock automatically. If you were taking a crap, you got locked in the bathroom until the crisis was over. But if the emergency power failed, everything unlocked again. The dead sentry had a dry, sweet, interesting smell, like cinnamon and sugar mixed together for toast. He had not bloated or rotted, he had simply dried up. There were still black discolorations under his neck, the distinctive trademark of Captain Trips. Standing in the corner behind him was a Browning automatic rifle. Trash Can Man took it and went back outside. He set the bar for single fire, fiddled with the sight, and then socked it into the hollow of his scrawny right shoulder. He sighted down on one of the porcelain conductors and squeezed off a shot. There was a loud hand-clapping sound and an exciting whiff of cordite. The conductor exploded every which way, but there was no purple-white glare of high-voltage electricity. Trash Can Man smiled. Humming, he walked over to the gate and examined it. Like the guardhouse door, it was unlocked. He pushed it open a little way and then hunkered down. There was a pressure mine here under the paving. He didn't know how he knew, but he did know. It might be armed, it might not be. He went back to the sand track, put it in gear, and drove it through the crash barriers. They broke off with a snapping, grinding sound, and the crawler's big balloon tires rolled over them. The desert sun pounded down. Trash Can Man's peculiar eyes sparkled happily. In front of the gate, he got out of the sand track and then put it in gear again. The driverless track rolled forward and pushed the gate all the way open. Trash Can Man darted into the guardhouse. He squinched his eyes shut, but there was no explosion. That was good. They really had shut down completely. Their emergency systems might have run a month, perhaps even two, but in the end the heat and lack of regular maintenance had killed them. Still, he would be careful. Meanwhile, his sand track was rolling serenely toward the corrugated wall of a long Quonset hut. Trash Can Man trotted onto the base after it and caught up with it just as it was bumping over the curb of what a sign announced was Illinois Street. He put it back into neutral, and the sand track stopped. He got in, reversed, and drove around to the front of the Quonset. It was a barracks. The shadowy interior was filled with that sugar and cinnamon smell. There were perhaps 20 soldiers scattered among the 50 or so beds. Trash Can Man walked up the aisle between them, wondering where he was going. There was nothing in here for him, was there? These men had once been weapons of a sort, but they had been neutralized by the flu. But there was something at the very rear of the building that interested him. A sign. He walked up to read it. The heat in here was tremendous. It made his head thump and swell. But when he stood in front of the sign, he began to smile. Yes, it was here. Somewhere on this base was what he had been looking for. The sign showed a cartoon man in a cartoon shower. He was soaping his cartoon genitals busily. They were almost entirely covered with a drift of cartoon bubbles. The caption beneath read, "Remember, it is in your best interest to shower daily." Below that was a yellow and black emblem that showed three triangles pointing downward. The symbol for radiation. Trash Can Man laughed like a child and clapped his hands in the stillness. Chapter 69. Whitney Horgan found Lloyd in his room, lying on the big round bed he had most recently shared with Dana Jurgens. There was a large gin and tonic balanced on his bare chest. He was staring solemnly up at his reflection in the overhead mirror. "Come on in," he said when he saw Whitney. "Don't stand on ceremony, for Christ's sake. Don't bother to knock. Bastard." It came out as bastard. "You drunk, Lloyd?" Whitney asked cautiously. "Nope, not yet, but I'm getting there." "Is he here?" "Who? Fearless leader?" Lloyd sat up. "He's around someplace. The Midnight Rambler." He laughed and lay back down. Whitney said in a low voice, "You want to watch what you're saying. You know it's not a good idea to hit the hard stuff when he's..." "Fuck it. Remember what happened to Heck Drogan and Strellerton." Lloyd nodded. "You're right. The walls have ears. The fucking walls have ears. You ever hear that saying?" "Yeah, once or twice. It's a true saying around here, Lloyd." "You bet." Lloyd suddenly sat up and threw his drink across the room. The glass shattered. "There's one for the sweeper, right, Whitney?" "You okay, Lloyd?" "I'm all right. You want a gin and tonic?" Whitney hesitated for a moment. "No, I don't like them without the lime." "Hey, Jesus, don't say no just because of that. I got lime. Comes out of a little squeeze bottle." Lloyd went over to the bar and held up a plastic real lime. "Looks just like the green giant's left testicle. Funny, huh?"
"Does it taste like lime?"
"Sure,"
Lloyd said morosely. "What do you think it tastes like? Fucking Cheerios? So what do you say? Be a man and have a drink with me."
"Well, okay. We'll have them by the window and take in the view."
"No," Whitney said harshly and abruptly.
Lloyd paused on his way to the bar, his face suddenly paling. He looked toward Whitney, and for a moment their eyes met.
"Yeah, okay," Lloyd said. "Sorry, man, poor taste."
"That's okay."
But it wasn't okay, and both of them knew it.
The woman Flagg had introduced as his bride had taken a high dive the day before. Lloyd remembered Ace High saying that Dana couldn't jump from the balcony because the windows didn't open. But the penthouse had a sun deck. Guess they must have thought none of the real high rollers, Arabs, most of them, would ever take the dive. A lot they knew. He fixed Whitney a gin and tonic, and they sat and drank in silence for a while. Outside, the sun was going down in a red glare. At last, Whitney said in a voice almost too low to be heard,
"Do you really think she went on her own?"
Lloyd shrugged.
"What does it matter? Sure, I think she'd dive, wouldn't you, if he was married to him?"
"You ready?" Whitney looked at his glass and saw with some surprise that he was indeed ready. He handed it to Lloyd, who took it over to the bar. Lloyd was pouring the gin freehand, and Whitney had a nice buzz on. Again they drank in silence for a while, watching the sun go down.
"What do you hear about that guy Cullen?" Whitney asked finally.
"Nothing. Doodly squat, el zilcho. I don't hear nothing. Barry don't hear nothing. Nothing from Route 40, from Route 30, from Route 2 and 74 and I-15. Nothing from the back roads. They're all covered and they're all nothing. He's out in the desert someplace, and if he keeps moving at night, and if he can figure out how to keep moving east, he's going to slip through. Well, what does it matter anyhow? What can he tell them?"
"I don't know."
"I don't either. Let him go, that's what I say."
Whitney felt uncomfortable. Lloyd was getting perilously close to criticizing the boss again. His buzz on was stronger, and he was glad. Maybe soon he would find the nerve to say what he had come here to say.
"I'll tell you something," Lloyd said, leaning forward. "He's losing his stuff.
You ever hear that fucking saying? It's the eighth inning and he's losing his stuff and there's no fucking buddy warming up in the bullpen."
"Lloyd, you ready?"
"Sure, I guess."
Lloyd made them new drinks. He handed one to Whitney and a little shiver went through him as he sipped. It was almost raw gin.
"Losing his stuff," Lloyd said, returning to his text. "First Dana, then this guy Cullen. His own wife, if that's what she was, goes and takes a dive. You think her double fucking gainer from the penthouse balcony was in his game plan?"
"We shouldn't be talking about it."
"And Trash Can Man, look what that guy did all by himself. With fiends like that, who needs enemas? That's what I'd like to know."
"Lloyd."
Lloyd was shaking his head.
"I don't understand it at all. Everything was going so good right up to the night he came and said the old lady was dead over there in the free zone. He said the last obstacle was out of our way, but that's when things started to get funny."
"Lloyd, I really don't think we should—"
"No, I just don't know. We can take him by land assault next spring, I guess. We sure as shit can't go before then. But by next spring, God knows what they might have rigged up over there, you know? We were going to hit them before they could think up any funny surprises, and now we can't. Plus, holy God, on his throne there's Trashy to think about. He's out there in the desert ramming around someplace, not sure as hell—"
"Lloyd," Whitney said in a low, choked voice, "listen to me."
Lloyd leaned forward, concerned.
"What? What's the trouble, old hoss?"
"I didn't even know if I'd have the guts to ask you," Whitney said.
He was squeezing his glass compulsively.
"Me and Ace High and Ronnie Sykes and Jenny Engstrom, we're cutting loose. You want to come? Christ, I must be crazy telling you this with you so close to him."
"Cutting loose? Where are you going?"
"South America, I guess. Brazil. That ought to be just about far enough."
He paused, struggling, then plunged on.
"A lot of people have been leaving.
Well, maybe not a lot, but quite a few, and there's more every day. They don't think Flag can cut it. Some are going north up to Canada. That's too friggin' cold for me. But I gotta get out. I'd go east if I thought they'd have me, and if I was sure we could get through." Whitney stopped abruptly and looked at Lloyd miserably. It was the face of a man who thinks he has gone much too far.
"You're all right," Lloyd said softly. "I ain't gonna blow the whistle on you, old hoss." "It's just all gone bad here," Whitney said miserably.
"When are you planning to go?" Lloyd asked. Whitney looked at him with narrow suspicion.
"Ah, forget I asked," Lloyd said.
"You ready?"
"Not yet," Whitney said, looking into his glass.
"I am." He went to the bar. With his back to Whitney, he said, "I couldn't."
"Huh?"
"Couldn't," Lloyd said sharply and turned back to Whitney. "I owe him something. I owe him a lot. He got me out of a bad jam back in Phoenix, and I've been with him since then. Seems longer than it really is. Sometimes it seems like forever."
"I'll bet.
But it's more than that. He's done something to me, made me brighter or something. I don't know what it is, but I ain't the same man I was, Whitney. Nothing like. Before him, I was nothing but a minor leaguer. Now he's got me running things here, and I do okay. It seems like I think better. Yeah, he's made me brighter."
Lloyd lifted the flawed stone from his chest, looked at it briefly, then dropped it again. He wiped his hands against his pants as though it had touched something nasty.
"I know I ain't no genius now. I have to write everything I'm supposed to do in a notebook or I forget. But with him behind me, I can give orders, and most times things turn out right. Before, all I could do was take orders and get in jams. I've changed, and he changed me. Yeah, it seems a lot longer than it really is. When we got to Vegas, there were only 16 people here. Ronnie was one of them, so was Jenny and poor old Heck Drogan. They were waiting for him. When we got into town, Jenny Engstrom got down on those pretty knees of hers and kissed his boots. I bet she never told you that in bed."
He smiled crookedly at Whitney.
"Now she wants to cut and run. Well, I don't blame her. Or you either. But it sure doesn't take much to sour a good operation, does it?"
"You're gonna stick?"
"To the very end, Whitney. His or mine, I owe him that."
He didn't add that he still had enough faith in the dark man to believe that Whitney and the others would end up riding cross trees, more likely than not. And there was something else. Here he was, Flagg's second in command. What could he be in Brazil? Why, Whitney and Ronnie were both brighter than he was. He and Ace High would end up low chickens, and that wasn't to Lloyd's taste. Once he wouldn't have minded, but things had changed. And when your head changed, he was finding out, it most always changed forever.
"Well, it might work out for all of us," Whitney said lamely.
"Sure," Lloyd said, and thought, "but I wouldn't want to be walking in your shoes if it comes out right for Flagg after all. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes when he finally has time to notice you down there in Brazil. Riding a cross tree might be the least of your worries then."
Lloyd raised his glass.
"A toast, Whitney."
Whitney raised his own glass.
"Nobody gets hurt," Lloyd said. "That's my toast. Nobody gets hurt."
"Man, I'll drink to that," Whitney said fervently.
And they both did. Whitney left soon after. Lloyd kept on drinking. He passed out around 9:30 and slept soddenly on the round bed. There were no dreams, and that was almost worth the price of the next day's hangover. When the sun rose on the morning of September 17th, Tom Cullen made his camp a little north of Gunlock, Utah. It was cold enough for him to be able to see his breath puffing out in front of him. His ears were numb and cold, but he felt good. He had passed quite close to a rutted bad road the night before, and he had seen three men gathered around a small spluttering campfire. All three had guns. Trying to ease past them through a tangled field of boulders, he was now on the western edge of the Utah Badlands, he had sent a small splatter of pebbles rolling and tumbling into a dry wash. Tom froze. Warm wee-wee spilled down his legs, but he wasn't even aware that he'd done it in his pants like a little baby until an hour or so later.
All three of them turned around, two of them bringing their weapons up to port arms. Tom's cover was thin, barely adequate. He was a shadow among shadows. The moon was behind a reef of clouds. If it chose this moment to come out... One of them relaxed. "It's a deer," he said. "They're all over the place." "I think we should investigate," another had said. "Put your thumb up your asshole and investigate that," the third replied. And that was the end of it. They sat by the fire again, and Tom began to creep along, feeling for each step, watching as their campfire receded with agonizing slowness. An hour, and it was only a spark on the slope below him. Finally, it was gone, and a great weight seemed to slip off his shoulders. He began to feel safe. He was still in the west, and he knew enough to be careful. Laws, yes. But the danger no longer seemed as thick as if there were Indians or outlaws all around. And now, with the sun coming up, he rolled into a tight ball in the low thicket of bushes and prepared to go to sleep. "Gotta get some blankets," he thought. "It's getting cold." Then sleep took him, suddenly and completely, as it always did. He dreamed of Nick. Chapter 70 Trash Can Man had found what he wanted. He came along a hallway deep underground, a hallway as dark as a mine pit. In his left hand he held a flashlight. In his right hand he held a gun, because it was spooky down here. He was riding an electric tram that rolled almost silently along the wide corridor. The only sound it made was a low, almost sub-aural hum. The tram consisted of a seat for the driver and a large carry space. Resting in the carry space was an atomic warhead. It was heavy. Trash could not make an intelligent guess as to just how heavy it was, because he hadn't even been able to budget by hand. It was long and cylindrical. It was cold. Running his hand over its curved surface, he had found it hard to believe that such a cold, dead lump of metal could have the potential for so much heat. He had found it at 4 in the morning. He had gone back to the motor pool and had gotten a chain fall. He had brought the chain fall back down and had rigged it over the warhead. 90 minutes later, it was nestled cozily into the electric tram, nose up. Stamped on the nose was A161410 USAF. The hard rubber tires of the tram had settled appreciably when he put it in. Now he was coming to the end of the hallway. Straight ahead was the large freight elevator with its doors standing invitingly open. It was plenty big enough to take the tram, but of course there was no electricity. Trash had gotten down by the stairs. He had brought the chainfall down the same way. The chainfall was light compared to the warhead. It only weighed 150 pounds or so. And still it had been a major chore getting it down 5 courses of stairs. How was he going to get the warhead up those stairs? "Power driver winch," his mind whispered. Sitting on the driver's seat and shining his flash randomly around, Trash nodded to himself. Sure, that was the ticket. Winch it up. Set a motor topside and pull it up stair riser by stair riser if he had to. But where was he going to find 500 feet of chain all in one piece? Well, he probably wasn't, but he could weld pieces of chain together. Would that work? Would the welds hold? It was hard to say. And even if they did, what about all the switchbacks the stairs made going up? He hopped down and ran a caressing hand over the smooth, deadly surface of the warhead in the silent darkness. Love would find a way. Leaving the warhead in the tram, he began to climb the stairs again to see what he could find. A base like this, there would be a little of everything. He would find what he needed. He climbed 2 flights and paused to catch his breath. He suddenly wondered, have I been taking radiation? They shielded all that stuff, shielded it with lead. But in the movies you saw on TV, the men who handled radioactive stuff were always wearing those protective suits and film badges that turned color if you got a dose. Because it was silent, you couldn't see it. It just settled into your flesh and your bones. You didn't even know you were sick until you started puking and losing your hair and having to run to the bathroom every few minutes. Was all that going to happen to him? He discovered that he didn't care. He was going to get that bomb up. Somehow he was going to get it up. Somehow he was going to get it back to Las Vegas. He had to make up for the terrible things he had done at Indian Springs. If he had to die to atone, then he would die.
"My life for you," he whispered in the darkness, and began to climb the stairs again.
Chapter 71. It was nearly midnight on the evening of September 17th. Randall Flagg was in the desert, wrapped in three blankets from toes to chin. A fourth blanket was swirled around his head in a kind of burnoose, so that only his eyes and the tip of his nose were visible. Little by little, he let all thoughts slip away. He grew still. The stars were cold fire, witch light. He sent out the eye. He felt it separating from himself with a small and painless tug. It went flying away, silent as a hawk, rising on dark thermals. Now he had joined with the night. He was Eye of Crow, Eye of Wolf, Eye of Weasel, Eye of Cat. He was the scorpion, the strutting trapdoor spider. He was a deadly poison arrow slipping endlessly through the desert air. Whatever else might have happened, the eye had not left him. Flying effortlessly, the world of earthbound things spread out below him like a clock face.
"They're coming. They're almost in Utah now."
He flew high, wide, and silent over a graveyard world. Below him the desert lay like a white sepulcher cut by the dark ribbon of the interstate highway. He flew east, over the state line now, his body far behind, glittering eyes rolled up to blind whites. Now the land began to change, buttes and strange wind-carved pillars and tabletop mesas. The highway ran straight through. The Bonneville Salt Flats lay to the far north. Skull Valley, somewhere west. Flying. The sound of the wind, dead and distant. An eagle poised in the highest crotch of an ancient lightning-blasted pine somewhere south of Richfield felt something pass close by, some deadly sighted thing whizzing through the night, and the eagle took wing against it, fearless, and was buffeted away by a grinning sensation of deadly cold. The eagle fell almost all the way to the ground, stunned, before recovering itself. The dark man's eye went east. Now the highway below was I-70. The towns were huddled lumps, deserted except for the rats and the cats and the deer that had already begun to creep in from the forests as the scent of man washed away. Towns with names like Fremont and Green River and Sago and Thompson and Harley Dome. Then a small city, also deserted. Grand Junction, Colorado. Then, just east of Grand Junction, was a spark of campfire. The eye spiraled down. The fire was dying. There were four figures sleeping around it. It was true, then. The eye appraised them coldly. They were coming. For reasons he could not fathom, they were actually coming. Nadine had told the truth. There was a low growling, and the eye turned in another direction. There was a dog on the far side of the campfire, its head lowered, its tail coiled down and over its privates. Its eyes glowed like baleful amber gems. Its growl was a constant thing, like endlessly ripping cloth. The eye stared at it, and the dog stared back, unafraid. Its lip curled back, and it showed its teeth. One of the forms rose to a sitting position. "Kojak," it mumbled, "will you for Christ's sake shut up?" Kojak continued to growl, his hackles up. The man who had awakened, it was Glenn Bateman, looked around, suddenly uneasy. "Who's there, boy?" he whispered to the dog. "Is something there?" Kojak continued to growl. "Stu." He shook the form next to him. The form muttered something and was silent again in its sleeping bag. The dark man, who was now the dark eye, had seen enough. He whirled upward, catching just a glimpse of the dog's neck craning up to follow him. The low growl turned into a volley of barks, loud at first, then fading, fading, gone. Silence and rushing darkness. Some unknown time later, he paused over the desert floor, looking down at himself. He sank slowly, approaching the body, then sinking into himself. For a moment there was a curious sensation of vertigo, of two things merging into one. Then the eye was gone, and there were only his eyes, staring up at the cold and gleaming stars. They were coming, yes. Flagg smiled. Had the old woman told them to come? Would they listen to her if she, on her deathbed, instructed them to commit suicide in that novel way? He supposed it was possible that they would. What he had forgotten was so staggeringly simple that it was humbling. They were having their problems, too. They were frightened, too. And as a result, they were making a colossal mistake. Was it even possible that they had been turned out? He lingered lovingly over the idea, but in the end could not quite believe it. They were coming of their own choice. They were coming wrapped in righteousness, like a clutch of missionaries approaching the cannibal's village. Oh, it was so lovely. Doubts would end, fears would end. All it would take was the sight of their foreheads up on spikes in front of the MGM Grand's fountain. He would assemble every person in Vegas and make them file past and look. He would have photographs taken, would print flyers, have them sent out to L.A. and San Francisco and Spokane and Portland. Five heads. He would put the dog's head up on a pole, too. "Good doggy," Flagg said, and laughed aloud for the first time since Nadine had goaded him into throwing her off the roof. "Good doggy," he said again, grinning. He slept well that night. And in the morning he sent out word that the watch on the roads between Utah and Nevada was to be tripled. They were no longer looking for one man going east, but four men and a dog going west. And they were to be taken alive at all costs. Oh, yes. Chapter 72. "You know," Glenn Bateman said, looking out toward Grand Junction in the early light of morning, "I've heard the saying, 'That sucks,' for years without really being sure of what it meant. Now I think I know." He looked down at his breakfast, which consisted of Morningstar Farms synthetic sausage links, and grimaced. "No, this is good," Ralph said earnestly. "You should have had some of the chow we had in the army." They were sitting around the campfire, which Larry had rekindled an hour earlier. They were all dressed in warm coats and gloves, and all were on their second cups of coffee. The temperature was about 35 degrees, and the sky was cloudy and bleak. Kojak was napping as close to the fire as he could get without singeing his fur. "I'm done feeding the inner man," Glenn said, getting up. "Give me your paw, you're hungry. On second thought, just give me your garbage, I'll bury it." Stu handed him his paper plate and cup. "This walking's really something, isn't it, Baldy? I'll bet you ain't been in this good shape since you were 20. "Yeah, 70 years ago, Larry said and laughed. "Stu, I was never in this kind of shape," Glenn said grimly, picking up litter and popping it into the plastic sack he intended to bury. "I never wanted to be in this kind of shape, but I don't mind. After 50 years of confirmed agnosticism, it seems to be my fate to follow an old black woman's god into the jaws of death. If that's my fate, then that's my fate. End of story. But I'd rather walk than ride, when you get right down to it. Walking takes longer, consequently I live longer. By a few days, anyway. Excuse me, gentlemen, while I give this swill a decent burial." They watched him walk to the edge of the camp with a small entrenching tool. This walking tour of Colorado and points west, as Glenn put it, had been the hardest on Glenn himself. He was the oldest, Ralph Brentner's senior by 12 years. But somehow he had eased it considerably for the others. His irony was constant but gentle, and he seemed at peace with himself. The fact that he was able to keep going day after day made an impression on the others, even if it was not exactly an inspiration. He was 57, and Stu had seen him working his finger joints on these last 3 or 4 cold mornings, and grimacing as he did it. "Hurt bad?" Stu had asked him yesterday, about an hour after they had moved out. "Aspirin takes care of it. It's arthritis, you know, but it's not as bad as it's apt to be in another 5 or 7 years. And frankly, East Texas, I'm not looking that far ahead." "You really think he's going to take us?" and Glenn Bateman had said a peculiar thing. "I will fear no evil." And that had been the end of the discussion. Now they heard him digging at the frozen soil and cursing it. "Quite a fella, ain't he?" Ralph said. Larry nodded. "Yes, I think he is. I always thought those college teachers was sissies, but that man sure ain't. Know what he said when I asked him why he didn't just throw that crap to one side of the road? Said we didn't need to start up that kind of shit again. Said we'd started up too many of the old brands of shit already." Kojak got up and trotted over to see what Glenn was doing. Glenn's voice floated over to them. "Well, there you are, you big lazy turd. I was starting to wonder where you'd gotten off to. Want me to bury you, too?" Larry grinned and took off the milometer clipped to his belt. He had picked it up in a golden sports supply shop. You set it according to the length of your stride and then clipped it to your belt like a carpenter's rule. Each evening he wrote down how far they had walked that day on a dog-eared and often folded sheet of paper. "Can I see that cheat sheet?" Stu asked. "Sure," Larry said, and handed it over. At the top of the sheet Larry had printed, "Boulder to Vegas, 771 miles. Below that, date, September 6th. Miles, 28.1. Total miles, 28.1. September 7th. Miles, 27. Total miles, 55.1. September 8th. Miles, 26.5. Total miles, 81.6. September 9th. Miles, 28.2. Total miles, 109.8. September 10th. Miles, 27.9. Total miles, 137.7. September 11th, miles, 29.1, total miles, 166.8. September 12th, miles, 28.8, total miles, 195.6. September 13th, miles, 29.5, total miles, 225.1. September 14th, miles, 32, total miles, 257.1. September 15th, miles 32.6, total miles 289.7. September 16th, miles 35.5, total miles 325.2. September 17th, miles 37.2, total miles 362.4. Stu took a scrap of paper from his wallet and did some subtraction. "Well, we're making better time than when we started out, but we still got over 400 miles to go." "Shit, we ain't halfway yet." Larry nodded. "Better time is right. We're going downhill. And Glenn's right, you know. Why do we want to hurry? Guy's just gonna wipe us out when we get over there." "You know, I just don't believe that," Ralph said. "We may die, sure, but it isn't gonna be anything simple, anything cut and dried. Mother Abigail wouldn't send us off if we was to be just murdered and nothing more come of it. She just wouldn't." "I don't believe she was the one who sent us," Stu said quietly. Larry's milometer made four distinct little clicks as he set it for the day. 000.0. Stu doused what remained of the campfire with dirt. The little rituals of the morning went on. They had been 12 days on the road. It seemed to Stu that the days would go on forever like this, Glenn bitching good-naturedly about the food, Larry noting their mileage on his dog-eared cheat sheet, the two cups of coffee, someone burying yesterday's scut, someone else burying the fire. It was routine, good routine. You forgot what it was all leading to, and that was good. In the mornings, Fran seemed very distant to him. Very clear, but very distant, like a photograph kept in a locket. But in the evenings, when the dark had come and the moon sailed the night, she seemed very close, almost close enough to touch, and that, of course, was where the ache lay. At times like those, his faith in Mother Abigail turned to bitter doubt, and he wanted to wake them all up and tell them it was a fool's errand, that they had taken up rubber lances to tilt at a lethal windmill, that they had better stop at the next town, get motorcycles, and go back. That they had better grab a little light and a little love while they still could, because a little was all Flag was going to allow them. but that was at night. In the mornings, it still seemed right to go on. He looked speculatively at Larry and wondered if Larry thought about his Lucy late at night. Dreamed about her and wished